Adam, your novel takes us inside the culture of graffiti writers. How did you come to know it so well?
I've spent most of my life being fascinated by graffiti and graffiti writers. I was a hip-hop kid growing up. I was into the music. I was a rapper. I was a DJ. So I tried my hand at graffiti, but more than that, I kind of realized that graffiti writers were the eccentrics and the weirdos and the mad geniuses of hip-hop culture. They labored in the dark, and they kind of had to balance all of these fascinating paradoxes in their lives. Fame and anonymity, art and vandalism, beautifying and destroying the cities they lived in, which were words that they often used almost interchangeably. So there was kind of a grandeur and an epic scale in my mind to what they did. So I was always kind of paying attention to graffiti aesthetically and also on a kind of, I don't know, almost a metaphorical level.
Hmm. Can you give us kind of a, I don't know, aesthetics of graffiti 101 for those of us who wouldn't even know what to pay attention to or what to look at in graffiti?
Well, I would say that one important thing to keep in mind is the fact that this movement began on the trains of New York City. You know, graffiti has always existed in some form, ancient Egypt, Pompeii, people were writing on walls there. But there's a particular genius to the fact that kids in New York City in the late 60s and early 70s thought to write their names on trains because they turned these pieces of public space into these mobile art galleries which circulated through the city. And the aesthetics of graffiti developed and were incubated by the trains. You had to consider what your name would look like moving very fast and pulling into a station. And you had to work literally in the dark in train yards where the trains were stacked very close together. It might be cold. Cops might raid you at any point. So there was a real energy and a buzz that allowed that scene to flourish. The three kind of categories of pieces, I would say, of graffiti are tags, throw-ups, and pieces, which are short for masterpieces. A tag is a signature. A throw-up is a simple fill, a two-color thing with an outline and a fill. And then a masterpiece is anything bigger and greater than that. So it could be a full-color mural that took 40 cans and 6 hours to do. I guess on a 101 level, I would say those are kind of the categories.
At the heart of your book, you profile or tell stories about some of these fictional but legendary graffiti greats. What makes really great graffiti? I mean, what separates an okay tag from a genius tag?
It's really a matter of aesthetics, how the letters flow together, how the name looks like in total. And it is name-based. I mean, graffiti is, in some sense, a form of literature. Like graffiti writers call themselves writers, not artists, not painters. So there is that component to it. How creative is the depiction of the word? How camouflaged? How elaborate? What does it look like in terms of motion? Does it look like it's moving? Does it look like it's static? Is it intended to create some kind of illusion in terms of depth or in terms of the flow of it?
Did you ever try tagging yourself?
Oh, yeah. I've got a few arrests and detainments on my record for that.
In New York? Where? I thought you grew up in Boston.
No. I grew up in Boston, so I was doing it in Boston. Again, I was never great at it. I didn't really have hand skills. I pretty much demoted myself to lookout pretty early on in the process.
Is it a really skilled thing to do?
Yeah, absolutely. It requires enormous hand-eye coordination and also bravado. I mean, there are writers who have reputations for the ability to get to seemingly impossible places, to paint on a highway overpass, for instance, which would seem to suggest that you had to hang upside down by your ankles and paint upside down. Those are called heaven spots or hangovers. That's an impressive feat. In Europe, a lot of train painting is done while the trains are in service, not parked, but simply waiting at the end of the line for 5 minutes to be cleaned. There are guys who paint ambidextrously because wow. They only have 5 minutes, and you would never know that they had 5 minutes when you see the end result.
Speed painting.
Yeah.
Well, so let's talk about your book. The narrator of your book is actually not a graffiti writer himself, but the 18-year-old son of two legendary writers. Tell us about him.
Yeah, it was important to me that the narrator of the book be an outsider to this culture, somebody who had some critical distance from it. I'd been teaching a hip-hop class at Rutgers University for a couple of years, and I was sort of trying to assimilate the fact that there's a generation gap within hip-hop, or several generation gaps within hip-hop, that the things I associate with the culture are not at all the things that an 18-year-old for whom it's always been popular culture, it's always been accessible, it's always been everywhere, is going to take from it. You know, for my generation, it's something that was birthed out of opposition and struggle. There's a social protest component to it. And for a lot of these kids, it's just pop music, and it's indistinguishable from other pop music. So I wanted the narrator, Dondi, to be a guy who has to toggle between generations and who is the inheritor of all this lore. But it's his parents' stuff, and it's as uninteresting as your parents' stuff always is. The book is in first person, and it was really liberating for me to write in his voice.
Well, the other thing is that it's not just written from Dondi's point of view. It's also in the vernacular of the culture he grew up in, the graffiti crew. And as language, it has the feeling of something new and kind of exhilarating, I guess. How would you describe what's going on, what you're doing with the style?
I think what I'm doing in the style, first and foremost, is trying to be true to the voice, to who Dondi is. He's a guy who's able to move pretty seamlessly between a lot of different worlds. He's a prep school student at a prestigious school that he refers to only as Whoop-De-Woo Ivy League, Wizzicumin Academy, but he's just been kicked out of it for selling marijuana. He's a really well-read and educated kid, but he also grew up around all of these kind of burnout graffiti writers, and he's able to code switch. He's able to mash up high and low culture instinctively and non-hierarchically, I guess I would say. And, you know, I wanted him to sound like everybody I know because I think that's a hallmark of my generation and certainly of hip-hop is that we draw influence and inspiration from everything, whether it's the Western canon or the lyrics of Jay-Z. And we don't privilege one over the other. It's a kind of intellectual democracy through collage. You don't give extra credit to something because its point of origin is cool, and you don't take credit away because its point of origin is corny. So I wanted Dondi to be true to that. And there's some, you know, there's a certain amount of literary gatekeeping around voices like that, around the ability to mash up those different forms. Either writers get sort of slapped for it or they get unduly credited for it as if they've alchemized some kind of incredible thing. And, you know, it took 20 tries and the first 18 narrators, you know, died on the operating table. And then finally one sort of staggered out and was able to reference both Homer and, you know, Billy Joel, you know, but it's just instinctive. It's what we do.
So are you saying, no, that's not like high style. That's how I talk.
It is, yeah. It's how I think a whole cadre of people talk, and I'm one of them for sure.
Well, so you referred to the war between New York City and the graffiti writers, which is at the heart of your novel. At its height, what was that war like?
Well, that war was first declared in 1972 by Mayor John Lindsay. And from 1972 until 1990, when graffiti was finally eradicated from the subway trains, the city spent $300 million. And keep in mind, at the time, the trains barely ran, and the city was teetering on the brink of insolvency. It was a mess. So there was more at stake than aesthetics. You know, graffiti didn't prevent the trains from running. In many ways, it was a very coded war. War on graffiti was a stand-in for war on young, poor people of color, because that was who was perceived as doing this vandalism. A lot of the tactics that we see today in terms of law enforcement and public space and public freedom really were ushered in by this war on graffiti. Zero tolerance policy, quality of life offenses, the elevation of misdemeanors to felonies, the epic incarceration that goes with that, the sprawling gang databases, all of that is kind of midwifed by the thinking behind this war on graffiti.
So this was a lot more than just an aesthetic war.
Absolutely. It was a war over public space and who had access to it and whether youth were going to be contained, abandoned, or listened to.
There's a story you tell in the book that I think I've read someplace else actually happened. There was a time when a bunch of young graffiti writers went to New York City, said, why don't you just let us paint for 6 months free, then let the public vote. And if they vote against us, we'll put down our aerosol cans. Did that really happen?
It really did. It's a scene in the film Style Wars, the great documentary about graffiti, which helped the movement actually to go worldwide. And it's a shocking and naive and beautiful moment because on one hand, there was never any chance that the city was going to accept this proposal. On the other hand, it's striking that in a war between the biggest municipality in the United States and a bunch of teenagers, the teenagers are the ones who are mature enough to approach the other side and offer a reasonable truce and an idea about how these two sides could come together. And what they were basically saying is, listen, we can stop tagging the insides of the trains. We know everybody hates that. We know it's perceived as intimidating and ugly. But most people actually like these colorful, vibrant murals we're doing on the outsides of the train. So just give us one train line. Let us paint. Don't arrest us. You don't have to pay us. Just leave us alone, and then let's see how the city feels about it. It's an eminently reasonable proposal, which was rejected out of hand. And the guy, Richard Ravitch, who they meet with, goes on to say, well, you know, if they want to contribute, I can give them all brooms, and they can contribute that way. And everything could have turned on a dime. A couple art scholarships, a press release, suddenly the graffiti plague could have become an innovative arts program. But the city didn't have that kind of foresight, and it didn't want to listen to young people then, and it continues, really, to not want to listen to young people now.
Is the war on graffiti still going on?
I would say that it is. I'll give you an example. The MTA at this point, ironically, offers advertising space on the outside of trains, the same places that were so highly contested where these burners, these masterpieces once ran and these kids got arrested for painting them there. You can now, for $50,000 a month, buy stripes of advertising and put whatever you want there. You can put a vodka ad featuring, you know, naked women in dog collars, the placards that have recently caused so much controversy in New York that have been referred to as hate speech against Palestinians were approved by CBS Outdoor, which administers these spaces on behalf of the city and the MTA. The one thing, however, that you cannot put on the outside of a train, even if you pay $50,000 a month, is anything that resembles graffiti. And I found this out because I tried to buy this advertising space to advertise this book.
So just because the cover of your book has graffiti writing on it, they
yes.
wouldn't let you advertise it on the...
Right. And that this is where the kind of bankruptcy intellectually of these policies comes to light, because the MTA and the NYPD's definition of graffiti is defacement of property. So the idea that a letter can be criminalized for its aesthetics when you're actually trying to pay to put it there doesn't make any sense. A graffiti-style letter in this context is like a robbery-style purchase. You know what I mean? It doesn't actually make sense. So yes, they apparently are still very much afraid of graffiti and at war against it.
Well, in your book, there's the climax of the book. There's this long overdue battle, a kind of showdown between the transit cops and the artists. And the graffiti writers conceive of this daring plan. They're going to paint all the cars on all the trains in the entire city in one night. Is that even humanly possible?
It's totally possible. I was very careful to do my research on that. I'm lucky enough to be friends with a lot of great graffiti writers, and a lot of these guys are walking historians of the movement, because so much of the history has been destroyed that a lot of artists sort of build up their own archives and do their own work and want to keep it alive. So I remember I was taking my friend Ket out to lunch. You know, we caught up and our food came, and then I sort of cut to the chase and leaned forward and said, okay, how would you paint every train in the city at once? Is it possible? What would you do? What kind of personnel? What kind of money? What kind of tactics? And he like looked around the restaurant and then leaned in close as well and said, I've been thinking about this for 20 years. And the rest is history. So, yeah, it's very doable. For anybody out there who's interested, you should probably stockpile a lot of bail money, but it is doable.
You know, one of my very favorite scenes or moments in the book is there's this scene where, you know, the New York City's graffiti writers were the first and invented graffiti and gave it to the world. And there's this scene where graffiti writers from around the world come to the aid of their New York City brothers. I mean, they're writers from Amsterdam and Germany and France, like this, you know, kind of underground worldwide brotherhood of graffiti writers. Does that exist?
Absolutely. It really is kind of a worldwide brotherhood. That's very well put. It's almost a fraternal organization. And
so there are women in it too, right?
Yes, there are. There are, definitely. There have always been women in the scene. Not a huge number of them, but there have always been important female writers from the very beginning. Barbara, 62, and Eva, 62, were some of the earliest. This was back when a lot of writers affixed the street name to the end of their name. That was later realized to be a good way to give the cops a roadmap to your house, so that was amended. Yeah, there are women, too. Yeah, absolutely. On a worldwide level, the scene is very well connected. When I travel to other cities, I check in with my local graffiti ambassador to see who lives there and thus who I can hang out with in whatever city I'm headed to.
Has it changed? I mean, by now we've gone through several generations of graffiti writers. How do the younger writers view the older ones?
Well, what I wanted to address in the book is the strange poignancy of having effectively outlived an art form that you created. And that's the position that a lot of these older writers, these guys who came up writing on the subway trains of New York, are in. They invented this style. They pioneered the aesthetics of it. They watched it go worldwide. They watched other cities pick up on it and younger generations, and yet it doesn't exist on the trains anymore. So for them, it's effectively dead, and they effectively sort of live in the past. I think graffiti isn't as based in mentorship and apprenticeship as it once was, because it used to be that writers would literally apprentice to each other. A younger writer would apprentice to an older writer and be rewarded eventually with an outline, which that writer would then be allowed to put on a train. So style was literally being handed down on loose leaf paper from one writer to another.
Wow, it's like the history of art all over again. I mean, that mentor-apprenticeship system, that's how, you know, Michelangelo learned to paint.
Yeah, that's right. And if it were the history of art, it would be compressed into this incredibly small amount of time. It would be 1969 would be cave drawings, and by 1974 it would be cubism. I mean, style was evolving at this remarkable rate. Like, when you talk to writers of that era, they emphasize the fact that they couldn't leave the city. They had to stay. They had to sit at the writer's bench on 149th and Grand Concourse and watch the trains go by, because if you went on vacation, you would be hopelessly outdated. Things were evolving that quickly, and individual trains, individual pieces would cause revolutions in style. When somebody invented a new technique, everybody saw it. Everybody was shocked by it. Everybody had to incorporate that into their next piece.
So you said that you wanted to explore what it would be like to have outlived your art. What is life like for those older writers who, you know, were there at the beginning and they're now 50, 60, and the trains are clean now, not covered with graffiti?
It's kind of sad for a lot of them. They're all well-respected guys within the scene. They get a lot of credit. They get a lot of adulation, but those things don't pay the rent. You know, most of these guys are working-class guys who are heroes to a small subset of diehard aficionados. Maybe they are able to go to Europe and paint and exhibit their art. Occasionally they get called on to be quoted. But for the most part, these guys are titans of a forgotten form who, yeah, kind of, you know, labor in obscurity and are very nostalgic. There are certainly guys who, you know, will call me right now and talk for 2 hours about who was king of the 4-5 train in 1977. And it's real to them. It's the past, but it's sort of more important than the present in some sense. That's not everybody, of course. There are also guys who have gone on to leverage their talent and become graphic designers and fine artists and work in advertising and all kinds of other things. So, I mean, not everybody is a relic of the past. Not everybody had their life ruined by graffiti. A lot of guys were able to springboard it into very successful ventures. But there are a lot of guys who I think are kind of trapped in amber in a certain kind of way.
Well, Adam, thank you so much for opening a door into this world. It's been really fun.
Yeah, thank you.